Hi, I'm Alex.
And I'm Tom.
And I'm Grant.
And on this very special episode of Flash in the Pan, we meet a dirty great alien monster!
That's it.
There we go. We grew up in a world of online animation. And we're digging you out for your consideration. Bringing you the tunes that made us who we are. Flash in the Pan. Hi, and welcome back to Flash in the Pan.
Welcome back.
We are your premier source of podcasts about animation from the internet from the past. As far as we know.
As far as we're aware.
Yeah, there might be other ones, but other ones don't have our very special guest. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Grant. You might recognize me from other such podcasts like History Honeys or 6 Feet Under or Sex Archie or my long-running presence as the sidekick part of the Chip and Ironicus Let's Play Empire.
Empire.
It's Empire.
I mean, you've lasted longer than some historical empires at this point.
Yeah, actually.
We can't call it a dynasty because then at least one of us would be required to have kids, and that's a lot of pressure.
Well,
I mean, there's a dog in the mix somewhere, and depending on which Paradox game you're playing, that could be legal.
Oh, no.
Very, very happy to have you with us, Grant. Yeah. So before we start off, you are, of course, a consummate internet guy.
Mm-hmm. I consummate all the time, I promise. Yeah. I know all about it.
That's what your file says, at least. And so, as with all of our guests, we'd like to ask, what's your history with Flash, with the animation of the our childhoods, really? The untamed wilds.
I mean, I was never as into Flash as a lot of my friends were, so I had to pretend to be to make them like me more.
Oh, no.
That's a big move.
There was one year. I spent three of my high school years in one school and one in a different. I moved just for sophomore year, right? And there's this crowd that I was like sort of into, you know, some certain interests, and they were cool, but they kept chanting about badgers, and I didn't know what the fuck was going on with that.
It was a social disease.
It was inescapable.
But I think one of my other big Flash memories is a cartoon that I know you did long, long ago. Like, this is early days for your show. I can't remember the title, but it was just a History of the World. Pretty nice Earth right there, right?
The End of the World.
Yes, the End of the World.
End of the World?
We watched that in class, not like behind the teacher's back, but like on the projector, right? It was...
Wow. Was this as part of the curriculum?
I mean, it was like a day or two from summer break, if I remember right. I don't know if curriculum.
Okay. So just kind of filling out the space.
So it wasn't like, good morning, I'm Professor Hendry, and welcome to Intro to World History. This should cover everything we'll be talking about in the next couple of months.
It does make sense that it was the end of the world and the end of school. You know, it's a bookend is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Did you get a chance to watch? Speaking of the end of the world, did you get a chance to watch the remake that happened a couple of years ago?
No.
Basically, it was the end of the world for real this time.
Yeah.
And it was with all of the possible cultural references of mid to late 2018.
Oh boy! Oh boy!
Mm. Yeah.
Never change, man. Never change.
Yeah.
The end of the world isn't necessarily what you came on here to talk with us about.
More about averting such a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because we are going to be talking about a very special and very interesting production. Usually, almost entirely, we talk about amateur productions, mm-hmm. fan productions. This is on the opposite end of the spectrum because this is a production by Auntie herself, the BBC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it is the Doctor Who serial, Scream of the Shalka. We obviously will have links to the cartoons, as well as a link to where you might be able to find the DVD release on our website, which is...
Wow.
Yes, there is. it might be out of print, but we'll find something.
Well, yeah, someone's got it.
It might be out of print, but it's definitely in my hand. Yes.
There you go.
You came prepared.
All right, so we know where to send people.
And yeah, you can find that all those links on our website, flashinthepancast.com. And yeah, this one's a long one, but it's definitely worth checking out before listening to the rest of this, because it will fill you with all sorts of emotions and maybe a few spooks as well.
Ooh.
Okay, but yeah, here we go with Scream of the Shalker.
Is it one of those rave things? What do they want to get in here for?
We're locked up for the weekend! Go away! There's nothing here!
Please, just run!
Mitch, they're making us do this!
Mitch, get back! Get back! Call the police!
Get off the fence! Get off the fence! Get away!
Stop me!
Get off the
Somebody
fence!
Stop
Don't...
me!
No! I won't do it! I don't want to be here.
You seem a nice young man. You should stay off the grass.
Why?
It's down there.
No wonder you're all afraid.
Sound makes you afraid.
I am Prime, War Chief of the Shalker Confederacy.
Homo sapiens has minutes to live.
Go. Go on. Save the world.
Doctor! Doctor!
You're human. Decent of you to say.
What are you?
Mildly annoyed.
And we're back, and that was a hell of an adventure.
He's got a beautiful singing voice.
He's got such a beautiful singing voice. I mean, why would you get Richard E. Grant and not make him sing?
Right, well, all mean, those musicals he's famous for, like Whitney Ellen and I. Yeah.
I think it's more a case of he only agreed to do it if he would be allowed to sing.
Yeah, probably.
But yeah, Scream of the Shalker is, as you were saying... during the watch, a very ambitious undertaking to make a full Flash animated 90-minute Doctor Who serial.
Yeah, and with the intent that it would be the new series. It would be the way the brand got relaunched in the 21st century.
Yeah, it's wild. It's especially one of my favorite things, just in terms of dating this. There are a lot of things that date this.
Oh yeah,
a lot of things which we'll get into. If you go to the website we have provided links for, there are options for low bandwidth and high bandwidth.
Yes.
And also each of the six episodes is split into several parts so that you can preload them on your dial-up connection. It says you might require using Flash 4 to be able to view the animations, which just tells you how far things have come.
They were very, very mindful in the creation of the animation about, like, the intent was that it would just play without buffering, and that depends a lot on your individual setup. There's only so much they can do.
Yes.
But that's why there are like pauses on establishing shots. That's why a lot of the look and moodiness comes from, you know, there are going to be characters that are just in silhouette for a while. So in effect, you just have a flat black shape. That's a much lower file size.
It's interesting. We'll get into the plot in a second, but I think that's a good jumping off point for just talking about the way that this looks and feels to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's We've talked a lot about on previous episodes about sort of the shortcuts that artists take using Flash as a medium, especially early versions of Flash, which weren't able to do nearly as many things. And one of the big things that this one does is you get a sense that the animators knew what Flash was bad at and just decided to not even try doing those things. So, for instance, you know, the animation itself is very limited.
You never see a person walking, at least not from the waist down. No,
you never see legs moving. The facial expressions are what had the most animation effort put into them, though, because of just the style and again the limitations, none of the characters are particularly good at expressing themselves.
Yeah, they got about 4 or 5. Maybe less.
You've got a depressed alien, a robot, and military people, so they don't really have to express themselves.
Yes.
No, that's true, but in a series which is built on the terrified scream, not being able to render a really good screaming face, I think...
I don't know, there were some great screaming faces.
Okay, there were some great screaming faces.
Incredible screaming
faces. But they were not animated screaming faces.
They were static.
They were traced over photos screaming faces. yeah, but like, limited... Having said that, you know, those limitations are very real, but in terms of the style, it really looks good, I think. Especially the like the really dark shadows. It feels moody. It definitely leans into the horror aspect a lot of the time. Which we'll get into more when we're talking about plot. I thought, and the character designs I actually quite liked. As simple as some of them are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was a bit, like, confused when the Doctor came up first. I was like, okay, so they just looked at Dracula and went, that's what we want.
Dracula, but with, like, a Cameron Diaz haircut. This Doctor, the Doctor that we have in this, at least design-wise, is very sedate. He looks like he would rather be curled up with a book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
sort of an Edwardian Gothic look, yeah.
Very, absolutely. Very Gothic, yeah.
He spends like a good chunk of some of the episodes going, I just don't want to be here. I don't want to do this. Which is unusual.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's the reluctant hero, and then there's just saying, look, I'm tired, I want to go home.
I want to go to bed.
Everyone's being so noisy. but, and to contrast that, we have the new companion, I suppose, in Allison. You know, she's pretty young, very early 2000s looking
incredible
woman of color. Like, she's got the beaded hair and the cornrows.
Slight midriff,
Only ever slight midriff, though.
Well, no, you'd have to show someone's lower body to get them.
Okay, fair. And there is definitely their relationship, I think, for me at least, felt a bit weird. Which let's pivot towards the actual plot of the thing. Right. We can get into some of the nitty gritty. Grant, would you like to kick us off?
Sure.
By telling
us
what this whole story is about.
I mean, what the story is about depends so much on what was going on behind the scenes. So I'm going to have to like allude to a few things, even though I'm sure we're going to talk more about it later.
All right.
Okay.
But, it is 2003. Doctor Who has been off the air for 15 years, and it's never coming back.
Never.
But it's the 40th anniversary year. So fans who happen to be in charge of certain parts of the BBC's web arm really want to make something. And so they've decided, you know, they knock on all the doors. They get meeting after meeting after meeting. Like, it sounds like just bureaucratic hell to get this made. They eventually get clearance and funding and everything that they need to make a brand new series, a web-based series. And they're going to commission a bunch of stories from a bunch of writers, and eventually it gets pared down to 1 6-part story. And that is what we have right here, Scream of the Shalka. And it starts with a meteor crash in the middle of New Zealand. We never see New Zealand again.
No.
Oh, so it's meant to be New Zealand.
Yes. Okay. Didn't you get that from the very authentic accents?
That's what threw me off. I was like, Australian? Like, no. Is it? I didn't tell.
Yeah, it's weird, because especially the guy in the sunglasses right at the beginning, I thought that he might have something more to do with it, because just he has kind of a shady look.
I mean, maybe that's...
But then he's also partnered with them with, like, a man with, like, powerful cut glass cheekbones.
Yeah. I mean, like, what? One of them's going on about Lava FM or like Lava.
I wrote this down. They were getting some kind of radio interference on the volcano, and to which one of them says, "Oh yeah, it's Volcano FM, rock by day, love by night." Which is how I like to live, personally.
But 3 weeks later, the doctor lands a brand new one who we've never seen before, portrayed by Richard E. Grant, looking, yes, like a vampire. Richard E. Grant needs no introduction, but I have one anyway. You saw him most recently probably in The Rise of Skywalker, his Oscar-nominated role in Can You Ever Forgive Me? This is the middle of his three Doctor Who appearances. His first was as the conceited doctor for about a minute of Curse of the Fatal Death years earlier. And the last and only canonical, although that's a fake idea that doesn't matter, as the Great Intelligence in 2013.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Richard E. Grant, kind of, he had an idea of what he was signing up for, but at the same time, he had no idea what he was signing up for with this kind of project.
Yeah. And you can sort of see that in the role. He's very stiff, very uncomfortable, and not just in the way that the character is uncomfortable, I think, although they are parallel in the beginning. But eventually he gets to, like, do things and be warm to people, and I think his voice... performance improves once those beats come along.
He becomes a lot more of what we in the UK would call a lovey toward the end of it. You know, he's got that camp energy. Yeah. He does the show tunes. He becomes, because at the start he's quite snippy and sarcastic in a mean way, and that sort of gives way to a friendly cattiness by the end.
Yeah.
Though he never stops being very rude about the military.
Which is correct.
So yeah, he lands in present day, by which I mean 2003. I forget where.
Lanarkshire.
Lanarkshire.
Yeah. In Lancashire, yes. In a town that he knows nothing about, and nobody's telling him anything because they're all afraid to make too much noise. And yeah, you can read between the lines that he's being sent as some sort of unwilling secret agent by a mysterious body that is putting him on these missions that he fucking hates.
Yeah, it's one thing that we both loved is that as soon as he touches down, he gets out, he smells the air, and he says, From the smell of the air, I think this is about 2003.
One of the first people he talks to is also, as we mentioned, Allison Chaney, a young lady working in a pub, sort of student age, but not a student, working class woman. Imagine if the show ever came back on TV, they'd probably also want to have their first companion, that same sort of vibe, I think. But maybe move it more toward the middle of London, you know, just...
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe cast a pop star, you know, someone that...
I think that's a bit unbelievable.
We'll just have to see how it plays out.
But she is played by Sophie Okonedo, who is 2 years away from her own Oscar nomination for Hotel Rwanda.
Oh, it's her!
Yes.
I knew I recognized that name.
Dang.
She returned to Doctor Who herself in 2010 as Queen Elizabeth the X.
Yes, she did.
Wow.
Amazing.
So it turns out the reason everybody is terrified is because there are lava monsters between their feet and that are like influencing everyone's brain through like subsonic vibrations. And if you do things they don't like, they will turn you into they will coat you in lava and dissolve you from the inside out. The doctor learns this by talking to an old bag lady who used to own 28 cats.
Yes. No, she was great. She was just really nice. And there's a very sweet scene where the doctor is, you know, she's like, hey, do you have any change? And the doctor's sorting through his pockets and he's just going through all of these stupid alien currencies.
Utter crap in his pocket.
Yeah, it's basically a riff on that one bit from The Hitchhiker's Guide. And it's very pleasing.
Yeah.
And although there is a really sour note where he says, you're not using euros yet, are you?
Oh.
Which in 2003... was a cute little ha 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 ha. In
2020,
in 2020,
that really fucking stinks.
Oh,
like I believe at that point I like wrote down like, okay, the doctor's not aware of Brexit.
It's a different universe, clearly.
The timeline's different. Diverged. Yes,
it's a different Lancashire, a better Lancashire.
In order to try and force his way into helping people so he can be allowed to leave, the doctor tracks down Allison, who lives with her boyfriend, Joe, who's played by Craig Joe. Kelly. He was in the middle of or just finished his role in Queer as Folk. He played Vince, a character who was himself obsessed with the program Doctor Who.
Oh my goodness, yes. Because Joe as a character is... He's just a dick. He is very, very unsympathetic, but also has the same kind of generic everyman qualities.
Yeah, I was going to say, apart from being a bit of a dick, doesn't do much else. He's very kind of...
Yeah,
sort of a bit of a non-character.
Joe is a medical doctor. He's a GP that does... No doctoring? No, he pokes at Allison's wound once in these six parts.
Yeah, he looks at it and goes, oh no, with, you know, which excellent is the, bedside manner.
That's the last thing you want to hear from a doctor who is also your boyfriend.
And be like, I've got this pain, and they look at you and go, oh no.
And they just leave.
Yeah.
So their vibe is that Allison is frustrated. She wants to do something. She knows that life cannot go on like this, but doesn't have a direction to exercise that feeling. Whereas Joe is very, keep your head down. Don't worry about the brainwashing. We'll be okay if you don't make a fuss.
Basically, yeah. It's very keep calm and carry on before that kind of blew up as a slogan.
But the doctor is definitely not having any of that. He improvises a fertilizer bomb and blows up one of these lava worms and thinks, that's it. That's the end. I wipe my hands. I'm ready to go home now. Oh, wait, I probably don't have one of those. Never mind.
He even says, oh, sorry about the house. As he's leaving these two people whose home he has coerced them into blowing up.
Sorry about your homelessness.
I know.
And destitution. Sorry.
It's very good.
All your belongings are gone. Whoops.
But it turns out he can't because his TARDIS has been swallowed up from the ground below. The town has been freed in the short term, but the problem has not been solved in the long term. So he enlists the help of the military. The British Green Jackets, an actual military service unit, a unit that is run by, I did not make a note, but yeah, the Major. I guess I didn't find any fun trivia about the guy that plays the Major.
No, he's a pretty cut and dry military authority figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's very much skeptical of the doctor's bullshit.
But he eventually comes around in a very like almost puppy dog way by the end of part six.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder why. And sort of old school Doctor Who fans will get this reference. I wonder why they didn't use the Brigadier.
Because the reason they don't use UNIT or the Brigadier, the reason they don't name the Time Lords is the people throwing him on these assignments. The reason they keep everything to the barest minimum is because this is a brand new thing for a brand new audience.
This was the reboot.
Yeah, yeah. In its planning and development, it was. The announcement of the actual reboot came about a month and a half before it aired.
Yes, I remember this.
So it really took the wind out of their sails and sort of primed the fan reaction against them in a way that was disheartening, along with the failure of their own publicity, but maybe we'll talk more about that later. The reason they stripped all of that out, I mean, even if you look to the relaunched TV series, they don't name the Doctor's home planet for 3 years.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah.
That sounds right.
God, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, wow.
It was it was the second Christmas special. It was The Runaway Bride when they first used the word Gallifrey again.
That's so interesting. It was a weird time for the series, for the franchise, mm-hmm. for the fandom as well, mm-hmm. at this point.
And the drive to make it the new thing is also part of why it's so dark and dreary and the Doctor's such an ass, really. It's that, no, it's not silly. It's not just for kids. It's serious. Look at every single Batman series or of films and like...
It's always darker.
Yeah. We're not... It's not spandex. Look at how dark and brooding this Tim Burton movie is. Wait, there's no bat nipples. Yeah. Look how like military surplus Batman Begins is.
Speaking of military surplus, the military as portrayed in this and just the general militarism on show, I suppose...
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Which we'll get into more in a second, reminded me a lot, especially in terms of style, of 28 Days Later, which has only come out the previous year at the time.
Yeah, that is definitely like the same zeitgeist, yeah. Starring Christopher Eccleston, if we want to keep
starring
drawing.
Christopher Eccleston. Yeah, there you go. It's like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but there are only ever about 2 degrees of Doctor Who in British showbiz. But yeah, so he loses his TARDIS. He has to do a thing.
Yeah, he basically hijacks the military industrial complex to solve his carjacking, and as they go, they go underground. The aliens are trying to steal the TARDIS because aliens are always trying to steal the TARDIS, dating back to like 1968 or whatever.
It's the ultimate mystery box.
But they cannot, in part because there is a very special security system in the shape of the Master, as played by Sir Derek Jacobi.
Which, again, is a fantastic get.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the great Shakespearean actor of today... Or, you know, 90s through a few years ago, at least, let the man rest. He had his run.
Yeah.
He had just recently been in Gosford Park with Richard E. Grant, so they had that in common.
Oh.
And at the same time, he was recording lines for Schalke. He was in a different studio recording lines for a Doctor Who audio play for Big Finish called Deadline by Robert Shearman.
Wow. Ah. So he was already knee-deep in the Doctor Who... world.
At least that summer he was. And of course he reprised the role of the Master for a few moments of live action in 2007.
Gosh, yes.
Yes, I remember that.
I haven't rewatched New Who, as it's called, in a long time. And so I'm getting sort of layers of nostalgia here.
Yeah.
So, Allison is kidnapped. She gets a scratch on her forehead. The Doctor gets shown this wormhole and gets thrown in it. He rescues himself by turning his cell phone into a secret door into the TARDIS.
Oh, yeah. not before trying to call the Major to issue his last words, but then he runs out of signal, and so he can't broadcast his last words to the universe, and that angers him enough to try to live.
That is a perfect moment of characterization. Like,
It really is, though.
If you were to revisit the Schalke Doctor, I mean, the one quirk is that he's just so name-droppy. Just constantly name-dropping.
That's the lovey in him, yeah.
Yeah.
But no, that bit of frustration and like self-importance that if he can't record his last words, he'll just have to live instead is what I think is really at the heart of him.
It's great because like he's talking about how he's made his peace with dying, how mm-hmm. he's old, he's past his prime, he accepts it, but he can't get the last word in, so he has, oh, well, I might as well save the human race. It's very good.
So he does, and the first place he goes is to the Major's office. They've basically commandeered a high school for a forward operating base, and they don't mention that in dialogue, so you just kind of wonder why there's a big blackboard and like drawings on the walls in this Major's office.
Oh yeah.
So he erases his answering machine before getting a moment of embarrassment. That's the first place he has to go.
Yes. Which again, like that is a really nice character beat. It shows what his priorities mm-hmm. are in that moment, and I like that.
Basically the whole middle bit, like the beginning is this sort of low-key, very slow and dreary base under siege thing, and that gets beat, and then the end, it's a globe spanning apocalyptic annihilation level event, and the whole middle is just a lot of business to connect the two and set up the plot beats that will pay off in the end, so it kind of gets muddled in my brain, frankly.
Yeah, I think so. I often do, I was taking notes throughout the whole thing because that's just the way that I do the podcast, dang it. And yeah, no, there are a lot of small things that happen that...
The military evacuates the entire population of this village, but none of them get where they're going. They all wind up in the middle of the woods, and that's important.
Yeah, they all wind up in the middle of the woods because it turns out that the Schalke are mind-controlling people.
Yes.
And
it's not only this village, it's small communities all around the world in a grid pattern. We eventually see a global projection, including some community of people living in the middle of the ocean.
So I was wondering about that, but right near the end, when it's cutting between all the different groups of people under mind control, we do see shots of some kind of boat.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So there's a ship sailing off the coast of Africa. Okay.
Where everyone just started screaming.
So, now these people are being much more directly mind controlled, in part because there's a little squeaky baby worm inside Allison's forehead, and one in every likewise community. None of these other communities get speaking lines, but they have some of the most horrific character designs.
Oh, they really do.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was talking about.
Like, Rasputin-ass zombie in like the Siberian group is terrifying, and the like half-starved Indian child.
Where the worm is emerging through a
bloody bandage over its forehead.
How are you going to know that the evil worms are all over the world unless you show a starving brown-skinned child?
There's no other way to know. There's no other way to depict that.
No. Like, that's... I mean, as far as I know, that's the only kind of person outside of good old Blighty.
Yeah, that's it.
There is a quip at the end about how the constant worldwide rain is going to make England comfortable enough to conquer the world again. But, you know, that's not the only moment of colonialism in this episode, it's fair to say.
That felt really, really weird and gross, and I didn't like that part. I was like...
Yeah. Well, okay. There are some lines along the on that theme that I want to come back to later, because right. I have a theory of some kind.
Okay, all right. Okay.
So while the mind control is going on, the Doctor has negotiated with the Shalka to basically let them into the TARDIS, because that way he can save Allison through a bargain. But
yes, they are about to just throw her in a lava fissure. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. They've got her like face first against this magma, and he's like, "Wait, stop. Okay, fine. Here are my keys."
And now they have to deal with the Caddy Master. We have to talk about the Caddy Master.
We have to, because what on earth is going on?
Yeah, like that really confused me. I was like, wait, why is the Master and the Doctor traveling together? Like,
because boyfriends.
They have extreme old boyfriends chemistry. Yeah,
like this is
like beyond Basil the Great Mouse Detective and Professor Ratigan levels of obvious boyfriend territory, you know?
There's that answer machine message.
There is the answer machine message.
Where it sounds like they're tickling each other. And it's like, are we supposed to hear this? Or?
I thought it sounded like the Doctor was having a tickle fight with an unnamed young woman, which is part of...
Okay.
That would make a little bit more.
Something he loves almost as much as name dropping in this serial is cryptic hints to a tragic past that has caused this status quo we've been dropped into in media res.
Yes. Although part of me really does hope it's just him and the Master.
Yeah, just that messy breakup.
Because it feels like there's more interesting stuff to explore there.
Are you curious about the tragic past? Because that was all outlined.
See, it was outlined so much that by the end of it, I knew that we wouldn't get a proper answer.
But, I mean, like, the answers were outlined in, like, a thing that the writer Paul Cornell was going to give to the other writers commissioned for this ongoing web series that wasn't ongoing.
So it would be... Mm. So it would have become part of the new show Bible.
Yeah, yeah, essentially. The Doctor fell in love and settled down with the daughter of the president of Gallifrey.
Okay.
Oh, that's some celebrity gossip.
Yeah.
But then there was a tragic invasion, and all the Time Lords escaped to the Matrix. They downloaded their brains into a big computer, and he's the only one that is like in a physical body out and about in the world. And so, as punishment, they are sending him as penance to be like the one time cop of the universe.
But
the Master is such a survivor that he downloaded his consciousness into a robot made out of TARDIS parts that can only exist in the TARDIS.
Yeah, and he mentions at one point that he chose that fate as the Doctor's companion over death.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes regrets it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which again, old boyfriend.
Yeah, yes. It's the most appropriate explanation.
Yeah, I imagine if this had got more episodes, it wouldn't have been long until we had whatever the gay Time Lord version of "Take My Wife, Please" is.
Take my life, please. Yeah.
There you go.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's another thing is that the Doctor does talk about being the ninth and that his. He even says to the cat lady at the beginning that, you know, he's run out of his nine lives and so on.
And there's a mention
also
of
the Warhol line. Yeah. He wanted to paint all nine of me.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting, because again, Warhol, probably the most name droppy kind of character that he could name drop.
But
it's great. It's,
okay, we've got roaming cadres of zombies all across the globe. Our English team is threatening some warehouse. It's a warehouse in the script and in dialogue, but it's just an outdoor space full of containers, big old freight containers.
Containers are very easy to draw in Flash.
So is the exterior of a warehouse. I don't know why that choice is made.
Maybe the containers are actually all tiny warehouses, and that's why the Schalker want to get to them.
But this, but I have to talk about this because it brings me to my last cast trivia note. The caretaker or warehouse man was split in two because there was a very enthusiastic young actor doing some recording for another project in the same studio who was over the moon when he discovered that they were making a new Doctor Who here. And so they split Warehouse Man into Warehouse Man 1 and Warehouse Man 2. And that is why David Tennant has an uncredited role in Scream of the Shaka. David Tennant.
Wow.
He thought this would be his only chance to be in the show that he loves so much. Little did he know.
Little did he know that just a few years later, he would indeed be playing Scrooge McDuck.
He's so good. I met him earlier this year. I told him that I'm very upset at the ducks for trying to make me cry all the time, and he appreciated that.
Wow! Now who's name dropping? Huh? That's really cool, though.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, also with the I think you mentioned this while we were watching when the. When the caretakers are beset by zombies, one of them says, "Is this one of those illegal raves?"
There are two references to illegal raves.
It's like, well, it's 2003.
It hasn't been an illegal rave for like at least 3 or 4 years.
Illegal raves are old news.
Yes.
With that in mind, it makes more sense for this aged caretaker to say that. But the first instance is that's how the military rediscovers their lost refugees. There is just a local beat cop who called in something assuming it was an illegal rave. And that's how.
Oh, wow.
So now we've got to the point where all of these communities have been assembled and they're going to scream into the sky. Because after part 5 starts with a regrettable amount of technobabble in order to like tie all these plot ends into what the big play is going to be.
It is some wonderful pseudoscientific technobabble, though.
Yeah, Schalka are a scavenger race that move into planets that are on the brink of ecological collapse, and they just push that balance a little bit.
So they
become dead worlds basically. That are really suitable for them who live in like the interior layers of the geology. And the way they do this is by mind controlling people to scream at the sky under certain whale song analogous frequencies.
Frequencies that change the molecular makeup of the atmosphere into something more volcanic that the Schalker like to breathe. Because, I mean, I know that when I want to make a cup of hot chocolate, I put the powder in the mug, I pour in the milk, and then I just scream at it for a solid 5 minutes.
Well, you haven't had your larynx trained for 3 weeks by these subsonic vibrations beneath your feet.
That's true. I couldn't afford the full subscription.
Prep time.
there is. It is quite interesting. I really did like the way that the Doctor, especially early on, is so outraged that, you know, this little town has been completely dark for 3 whole weeks. And he's genuinely very angry that no one's doing anything about it. Mm-hmm. Because that means that he's got to sort something out. But B, because you do get the sense that, like, you know, he does still have a sense of justice. Mm. And a sense that, well, something has to be done. Why are you all being, you know, cowards about it? I mean, the reason they're being cowards about it is because they will be turned into rock monsters.
Yeah.
But... It's a dead rock monster.
There is the account that's repeated about the woman who...
Oh, that was so fucked up!
Who covered herself in lava, screaming the entire time.
Yes.
Until she didn't have any hands. It's like...
And he's like, but why are you scared?
Yeah. No, that little monologue that Alison gives... Like early on was like the first insight. I remember way back because I watched this way back when it first dropped online. When I was 13, And I watched it in the school computer labs. And I remember that particular line making me go, ugh.
I mean, it is a little bit still like, wow.
Yeah, it's horrific. And the moments where Scream of the Schalke really embraces its horror heritage, I think, is some of the strongest.
It gets really good, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't actually talk about the monster designs.
The monster designs are really cool, especially Prime, the Prime yes. Schalke, very cool.
Yeah, they're these huge, horrible worms, but they have these kind of beak-like toothed mouths.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when they scream, it's this lava glow splurting from their throats. And yeah, it's really cool. And again, the design allows the animation team to do a lot with them that they couldn't with, say, some kind of spider monster, where you need to articulate all of the legs to move and so on. If they're worms, then you can do some decent wiggling.
Yeah.
In Flash 4.
Which would look better in Flash than it would in live action. They don't do worms on the show. They just don't.
No.
They don't do worms. They don't do snakes.
But Prime has her, I don't know. It's not specified. Prime has an extremely good moment at the end of episode 5 where they just straight up say that you know they are here to cause the full extinction of the human race. And like, if at any point in my life I get to say that to someone, then I will be very satisfied.
Yeah,
but yeah, I really enjoy Prime's design in particular for taking the look of the Schalke and just being so like imperious and
yes,
regal, but like evil regal. In the way it's refined, it's a very, very good looking monster.
Yeah, with this huge sort of cowl design around the neck and head. And again the acting is good as well. Like the voice acting in this generally is pretty solid. And I think the Schalke's voice acting, apart from the incessant sound effect of the screaming, which you can tell they're really proud of the horrible noise they made in the telephonic workshop.
So the way this plot wraps up is, you know, we have 1 hour on the clock before the screaming has achieved its goal irreversibly, and the volcanic ash is like the primary ingredient in Earth's atmosphere through screaming,
which is bad.
And so the doctor takes Allison back down into the caverns and tries to hijack their control mechanism, their control relay for directing all of the human slaves to do the screaming by singing a number from Cabaret, which, yes, thank you. A personal gift to me. but there is essentially a shouting match, more literal than usual, between the Doctor and Prime. And the Doctor is taking the sonic punches as sort of a rope-a-dope to get knocked back toward the control facility in order to switch on their transit wormhole into execution and waste disposal black hole to destroy Prime.
Yeah, they really should have separate doors for that.
And then uses Allison's mind link with like a slight little bit of reprogramming to turn her into Queen of all Schalke to get the human slaves to stop.
Yes. Oh, and in between these things happening, Allison's headworm has been removed by the Doctor, put in a jar. And then the Doctor takes it out of the jar and swallows it so that he can learn everything there is to know about the Schalke.
Yes. This is, I think, the only episode, unless I'm forgetting something, of Doctor Who where you see the Doctor's innards from within.
Yeah. Yeah.
I gotta update my wiki page. I don't...
Is it also the only episode of Doctor Who where he deliberately climbs into the mouth of the monster that's threatening him?
And then says, yeehaw.
He doesn't say, he screams,
I think he's probably deliberately climbed inside some large monsters, but I don't think he's ever shouted, take me home, big boy, in any other case.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that was a Richard E. Grant ad lib.
Wow.
I am not surprised in the slightest. Everyone knows that Richard E. Grant, really big fan of Vorophilia. It's in his autobiography if you read the wrong pages.
Without getting the boulder all the way up to the tipping point, the atmosphere is beginning to heal itself. It's raining worldwide. The doctor's leaving. The master is talking to Allison, saying like, "Hey, he's not going to ask you to come, and I really don't want you to come, but you should probably come with us."
For a life as an adventurer and really irritated third wheel.
So they have the now classic scene between our present day working class 19 to 21 year old and her useless boyfriend. Like, hey, where are you going to go? Turn left, turn right.
Yeah, and unsurprisingly, she chooses the magic spaceman mm-hmm. instead of her boring dick of a boyfriend.
That's the correct decision. I think most people would agree.
Yeah. This is where I want to get into the... And that's... It's all wrapped up nicely.
Yeah.
The doctor basically exterminates thousands of aliens, but they were evil aliens.
So it's okay.
It's okay that he sang at them until they exploded.
And they have millions of other planets. They'll be fine. Yeah, they'll be fine.
And right at the end, before getting on the TARDIS and buggering off, the Doctor and Allison have this weird moment of closeness, and he gives her a little kiss on the forehead.
Yes.
And then her boyfriend does the same thing.
Yeah.
Later on, it's like, why is everyone... What?
And I think they chose
she
that
has
particular...
a leaking wound on her forehead. That's unsanitary.
That's not hygienic.
I think they did it because this is 2003. You know what the biggest film franchise at the time is? Lord of the Rings. You know what franchise involves a lot of forehead kissing?
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings.
Is that why it starts in New Zealand?
That's why it starts in New Zealand. It's all coming together. That's Scream of the Schalker, and Grant, you've done lots of research about this, which means it's time for some Flash.
That's the Richard E. Grant version.
Yeah, okay. That's fine, we'll just edit them all in.
So you want to hear some behind the scenes making of facts? All right, so before we get to specific facts, I just have some more notes. It's like cast notes, but they didn't use their voices. Crew notes, I guess. This is animated. The animation studio was Cosgrove Hall, which if you follow British TV animation from the 70s through 2000s, you might recognize.
Absolutely.
Some of their most famous titles were Danger Mouse, Count Duckula, and the first 16 series of Bob the Builder.
Yeah.
Yep.
All absolute ironclad classics.
Yeah.
Bob the Builder even had a number one single over here.
Oh, God, don't remind me. I tried to forget.
Actually, no, he had two. He had the regular Bob the Builder theme released as a single, but also a version of Mumbo Number 5.
Cosgrove Hall was shut down by their owners. One of the TV networks, I think ITV owned them in the end, in 2009. So. Mm-hmm. The director, this was directed by Wilson Millam, who is primarily a theater director. When I say primarily, this is his only IMDb credit.
Wow.
This and a play he directed that was then filmed. in plays, before doing Scream of the Schalke, he directed both Matt Smith and David Tennant on stage in various things. He is also the director of the original stage production of Killer Joe, which makes him close to my heart as a Tracy Letts super fan.
Nice.
This was written by Paul Cornell, the novelist, comic, and TV writer. He's the first person to be Hugo nominated in those three forms of media, or any three separate forms of media.
That's very impressive.
He began his writing career with Doctor Who fanfic and was a pretty major fixture of the spin-off novels when Doctor Who was off the air for those 17 years or so. He wrote three fantastic episodes for the new series, but recently made a pledge to only work on his original IP, though he keeps finding occasional excuses to dip back in for little things and in a lot of the franchises that he loves. He wrote his drafts for Scream of the Shalka while in New Zealand on his honeymoon. That's why the meteorite lands in New Zealand.
Okay.
Because he just loved the countryside while he was working out the various drafts. In fact, he sent off his first draft on his way to the airport, but it got caught in the BBC spam filter. So he had to call home to a trusted neighbor to break into the house, like break a window to open the door to get into the house. Turn on my computer, send this email again. I am getting on a plane. And so while his lovely wife was, you know, checking out Lord of the Rings filming locations and doing all the tourist things, he was in the hotel room on a laptop doing second draft, third draft, etc.
Oof.
The executive producer, one of the executive producers, the one who I found fun facts for, is James Goss, listed as a BBC senior content producer. What that meant was he was in charge of the BBC's cult website. This was an umbrella site where they did a lot of Doctor Who stuff. Doctor Who was a big part of it, but also Bagpuss and Blake Seven and Buffy. It became just the Doctor Who website in 2005 with the start of the new series. He since had a hand after this in producing more animated episodes with Cosgrove Hall. They animated some of the missing episodes for The Invasion, a partially present, partially missing second Doctor story from the 60s.
Oh, yes. I remember reading about that.
He even wrote a few Torchwood spinoff novels.
I mean, of course there are spin-off novels.
Yeah.
Of course.
This is the fourth BBCI webcast. The previous three were made in-house on a much shorter budget. In fact, the first was made for Real Player specifically and transmitted the images through a feature that was meant for subtitles. Just a bit of a clutch, yeah.
That's a cool workaround.
Wow.
What were the other previous BBC broadcasts?
Death Comes to Time, which was commissioned as a BBC Four radio script that didn't get produced. So they just had extra content lying around that's made for not looking at things. So it was pretty easy, and just having any sort of a slideshow at all was bonus. And the second one was a Sixth Doctor thing that I can't remember the title. And the third was the Eighth Doctor adaptation of Shada, which was an unproduced or rather half-filmed Fourth Doctor script that was never completed due to industrial action. I believe an electrician's strike. They were the people striking at the time. But wow. It's something that people loved because it was an unproduced Douglas Adams script that was...
That's why I've heard of it. Okay.
Yeah. The novelization of Shada is very, very good. Check out the novelization. It is better than any of the versions they've put together with the filming that was done and linking narration, or this adaptation to instead make it a Eighth Doctor and Romana story rather than a Fourth and Romana story. So I mentioned all the bureaucratic hell that they went through. Part of that is clearing the legal rights to make a new production and going through all these hurdles, because at the time, in the early 2000s, from the way they tell the story, at least, the idea was everybody knew, it was common knowledge, that the rights were this big Gordian knot that you could never untangle. Just a big, big mess because of all the different freelance interests and shares going on in the 60s through 80s. You know, it's a long time for a lot of clauses to have to muddle through. So nobody ever tried. These people tried. They actually did the work, and they checked, and the really complicated things were stuff that they just didn't have to have. The brand, the name, the all the stuff they wanted to use were fine, actually. And so they started. Then, while they were under works, because not only are people internally excited about the 40th anniversary, fans are excited about the 40th anniversary and thinking, wouldn't it be nice if the show came back with all the new, you know, special effects technology we have, with all the writers who are now working in television who are inspired by Doctor Who. This is a great opportunity. But they're hearing from BBC sources that the rights are a mess. And then they're, but they know there is this internal thing that's already been announced, that this webcast, like, wait, did you lie to us? Is this webcast not actually happening? And so a lot of meetings happen, and the BBCI producers show their homework, and their clearance of the rights paved the way for the new series to actually exist.
So the revival of Doctor Who wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for untangling legal gubbins for this animated installment.
Perhaps it wouldn't have happened exactly the same way. They would have had to go through it themselves, and who knows, you know, what delays that would have made, what sort of thing might have happened if that butterfly flapped its wings differently early on in the process. That's all I'm saying. I don't know. But it was a step along that path.
That's really neat.
That's really, really cool.
Speaking of the 40th anniversary, the first episode of Scream of the Shalko went live on November 13th, 2003, about 10 days shy of the actual date. But a couple months, like I mentioned, after the new TV series was announced that would eventually premiere in 2005. Even with that announcement, the producers were trying to turn the web animation into an ongoing series that could exist alongside. Isn't that cute? A second serial even got commissioned. It was already being written by Simon Clark, a novelist famous for Night of the Triffids at the time. He was calling his story Blood of the Robots. Bum, bum, bum.
Oh, that's such a good title.
It's a good title. Yeah. Paul Cornell attended a early screening at a film museum and gave an interview and had a lovely time. But the story gets interesting there the moment where he left. And as he left this event, suddenly cheers went up. People started streaming into the streets. They're waving flags. They're chanting. It was coincidentally the moment England won the Rugby World Cup. Still, until he figured out that's what was up, it's got to be a nice feeling.
Wow.
Internally, the production was nicknamed sort of informally Project Eddie, since one of their first casting ideas when they were just, you know, making dream lists was for Eddie Izzard to play the Doctor.
Oh my goodness! Okay. That would have been very interesting.
Yeah.
Pop star Robbie Williams was also very interested in the role.
Oh wow! Especially that 2003 era Robbie Williams.
Yeah.
Troubled Robbie. Very strange.
Shalka was, like you'd expect all of your alien menaces to be, just a made-up nonsense word that feels right in the mouth, right? But you have to, when you have your made up nonsense words, you have to get it cleared with the BBC's lawyers. They do research to find everything that happens to have the same word, whether you meant it or not. So there are two previous things named Shalka. One, a meteorite that landed in India in 1840. Whoa.
That's okay. Great. Okay.
And two, a Virginia-based rock band that happened to break up in the fall of 2003 when Scream of the Shalka was airing.
Oh no!
I mentioned earlier that there were some problems with the publicity on this project. That is, the most dramatic case is when their publicist sent out invitations for this big press event to be held at the recording studio during the process. She did not attend herself.
Ooh.
And so there's this there are these journalists wandering around the studio unattended, which Richard E. Grant, as a professional, objected to, understandably. And so the producers locked this journalist in a closet. And the advance coverage, I will say, was not favorable at following this event.
Oh my God.
There are two ways that Scream of the Shalka influenced Russell T. Davies' plan when he was creating, along with his production team, the new series of Doctor Who. One was he didn't really like how Richard E. Grant played the Doctor, so like he was never included in their casting wish list. And two was pointing at this Doctor Who Monthly or Doctor Who Magazine, whichever title it had at the time, article about their representative getting locked in a closet and showing it to you know, his show's publicist team, like, don't do this. Never, ever do this. Do not embarrass the production this way.
Generally, locking someone in a cupboard is not a good way to, like, endear yourself to people.
No, it's... I can't get over it. That's such a ridiculous, farcical thing to do to completely sabotage your goodwill in advance of, you know, what must have been a very, like they must have had a lot riding on it being a success.
Mm-hmm.
And just to do that, it's so shit. It's like the thick of it levels of shit.
Yeah. Couldn't write it.
This project we're speaking about, Scream of the Shalka, is an award-winning animation.
It
won the Big Chip Award for Best Digital Animation that year. The Big Chip is apparently, according to them, the UK's longest running digital industry award.
Never heard of it.
So
I've never heard of it.
It was nominated and presented for Best Digital Animation by digital industry people, dot com heads, I guess.
Oh, okay. All right,
okay.
I mean, they were still coming down off the bubble bursting, so... also, on a side note, Big Chip, I mean, if your partner in crime needs a new online handle...
Yeah.
It's ironic. those are the flash facts I collected for you today.
No, that was you've gone above and beyond in terms of the research. I mean, I could tell just from our pre-recording our discussions about this, you did seem very excited to talk about this.
One thing that I failed to mention, when we talked about David Tennant's uncredited cameo appearance as Warehouseman 2, or Caretaker 2, that character is given a name in the novelization. His name is Mitch Stannard. If you want to write any fan fiction about Mitch Stannard meeting the Doctor that looks like him, now he has a name.
I mean, I'm sure that it's already on AO3.
I was surprised if it doesn't exist already.
There's no segue to this, but I would hurt myself. I would be upset with myself if I didn't mention it. Scream of the Shalka is absolutely in canon again following the recent series of Doctor Who that just concluded. Late last year, early this year, whenever it ended.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are a season behind, unfortunately.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So no spoilers, but real heads know.
I have osmosed enough information to know what you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
The idea that the Doctor has had other faces who might be working against their will doing secret missions for the Time Lords was, shall we say, prescient. The Shalka Doctor is the easiest one to fit back into continuity.
Hmm.
Yeah. So connected to previous Doctor Who series,
mm-hmm.
Or rather the original series, over here in Blighty, we use the word series to mean season. So
yes.
We do,
yeah, we do.
But Shalka's connection to previous series in terms of characterization, in terms of in terms of general lore and so on is really bare bones.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I remember it from way back when, if I can put on my talking about my teenage years hat for a while, because for me, Doctor Who kind of started with the 40th anniversary. Mm. Because until, like, the, I guess, 2002, early 2003, I, as, you know, someone who was born in 1990, I'd been aware of Doctor Who on the periphery, but we didn't have reruns.
No.
We didn't have, like, your only chance of getting to watch Doctor Who would either be to pick up a video box set, in which case you need to know what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Or, if you're fortunate enough, like I was growing up, to have satellite channels, maybe on like UK TV Gold or something, they'd be showing one out of order Tom Baker serial for, you know, at like 8:45 p.m. on a Tuesday.
Yeah, and it would only ever be like Tom Baker. You'd never get. Never get any of the other ones.
I know. I did see. I completely forgotten which one it was because it was that long ago. But one of the first ones I saw was a story with Ace, in which she did beat the crap out of a Dalek with a baseball bat.
Excellent.
Well, that would be Remembrance of the Daleks.
There you go. There you go. See, real heads know.
Yeah. It's the one with segregation in it.
Wonderful.
Great. Okay.
I mean,
Ace is not a fan of the segregation. To be clear, it is presented.
She was a cool with it 80s girl.
Yeah.
But my first proper exposure to Doctor Who was, not just watching Scream of the Shalker, but also seeing all of these TV specials and nostalgia specials on the BBC about how great Doctor Who was back in the day.
Yeah. Didn't BBC Two run a lot of reruns? I mean, that's probably what you're remembering, right?
Not really. It was mostly just nostalgia, as far as I can remember.
They would just be like, do you remember when Doctor Who was great? We're not going to show you.
This is what happens when, you know, I don't live in the culture of immersion, just the culture of, like, watching documentaries on DVD releases, right? A series of reruns on BBC Two for the 40th anniversary were a big thing. Like, okay, I'll take your word for it.
I mean, if they were, then I never actually watched them.
I wasn't ever aware.
Because, Doctor Who at the time was very much, like you mentioned earlier in the episode, you mentioned how the guy that plays generic bad boyfriend, was Vince from Queer as Folk, who is a big Doctor Who fan.
Yeah.
And like his Doctor Who fandom is about where it was in the cultural, in the cultural milieu of the time. Just this kind of slightly embarrassing, outdated sci-fi thing that only real saddos would get into. You know, like, this is before the whiz bang revival and the rebirth of the Juggernaut. But because of that, my main exposure to Doctor Who was from the massive hardback collectible 40th anniversary book, The Legend. Doctor Who, The Legend, 40 Years of Time Travel.
Oh my.
Which basically had a synopsis for every single episode, along with production stills, screenshots, plot details.
I wonder,
behind-the-scenes stuff.
One of the interviews with the director mentioned getting a book like that. I wonder if it's the same book.
It could.
You might have been working from the same source material as the director of Scream of the Shalka.
Maybe. I mean, it came out just before Scream of the Shalka. I think I got it for Christmas that year, but in that book, right at the end, because it has these segments where it profiles all the different doctors, right at the end, there is a section that says Doctor Who: The Legend Continues. This is a profile of the Ninth Doctor, played by Richard E. Grant. Here is a full biography.
Wow,
and it's really interesting because. Like, that was from a time, you know, and this was made, there's no mention at all, as far as I can remember, of the 2005 revival. It was just, hey, these are the first eight Doctors. Here's all the adventures they went on. Here's the Ninth Doctor. Let's learn about him. What kind of adventures is he going to go on, kids? The answer is none. But...
well, the answer is one.
Okay,
he goes
one.
On one, yeah.
Reluctantly, he goes on one, yeah. It's strange that I kind of got into Doctor Who backwards, I suppose.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, like, a lot of people our age did.
Yeah.
Like, because what you're describing is, like, nearly identical to... Like, I never saw this. I never saw Scream of the Shulker. But, like, my parents would talk about Doctor Who with fond memories. And it would occasionally get mentioned on television. Mm-hmm. They'd never rerun it. And then I wouldn't ever really get, a real sense of what Doctor Who was about until Christopher Eccleston's run.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, until... I mean, by the time the New Who started, I'd seen Scream of the Shulker. And I'd maybe watched, like, two or three episodes, even, on telly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of them was from Pyramids of Mars.
All right, yeah.
And the other one would have been Remembrance of the Daleks. But, like, apart from that, until it properly started again, all I knew was all of the ephemera and all of the lore and all of the background information. You know, it's like reading a biography of, I don't know, Leonardo da Vinci without...
Actually, and
seeing maybe, like, five of his sketches.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yes, I did somehow just compare Leonardo da Vinci to Doctor Who.
Congratulations, well done.
I'm glad Leo's finally getting his due. I'm sure he appreciates it.
Yeah. If only he designed a TARDIS. Come on, Leo. It's not that hard.
No, he just made 8 Mona Lisas, and 7 of them say this is fake on the back, obviously.
Yeah.
Isn't that a plot point in the card game Chrononauts?
Wait.
Oh, no, there are in Chrononauts, there are 3 Mona Lisas.
Oh, yes.
Wait, Chrononauts riffed off City of Death? Wait a minute.
I mean...
I can't allow this.
But yeah, so that was our experience. Mm. And like that's just the pop culture world that Shulker came out in. And again, like casting like Derek Jacobi and Richard E. Grant was like that wasn't for the kids.
No.
Yeah. A plurality of the cast of Gosford Park. That's who the kids love.
Although I do like the mental image of Derek and Richard like in their in full Gosford Park. Get up, just like running lines from Doctor Who.
It's not impossible.
It's
it could have happened.
It could have happened.
We weren't there.
But one thing I do need to mention, because I brought it up ages ago, another big thing that was happening around this time culturally was the start of the War on Terror.
Okay. I think I see where you're going with this.
So this, you know, this is late 2003 in a deeply divided British cultural space.
Yeah, Iraq has been invaded.
There
has been both shock and awe.
Yeah, there's been shock, there's been awe, there's been endless political cartoons about being unable to find weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. You might remember the Finding Nemo pastiche on 2D TV, where it's Tony Blair and George Bush as fish looking around the ocean floor for weapons of mass destruction. Because I remember that.
I only remember it because you just made me remember it.
Our WMD political cartoons over here had a very different leaning.
Yes, they did.
They loved to draw was like clearly a nuclear missile, but painted to look like Saddam and passed off as a statue.
Oh, classic.
That was the big gag here.
That's why it was interesting with that shit happening in the background that this is a story about like a British population forced into silence by powers beyond their control. it's a story in which the Doctor is overtly anti-military. Basically taunts the Major in their first meeting, says that the military have only done 3 things for him: arrest him, make tea that's too sweet, and kill his friends. And that's a really powerful thing to have your hero of a beloved Revive franchise say to a military officer's face in November of 2003.
And then an episode or two later, the other soldier gets used as an unwilling guinea pig and nearly has his face bitten off by an alien monster.
Yes, he does.
With no remorse.
Oh, we didn't even talk about him. What's his name? Wicks?
He was Irish.
Greaves.
That's right. Greaves, which again, it means is miserable. And he just gets dumped on the entire time, which is fair enough because he's characterized as like a bit of an asshole. He's pretty trigger happy. He's very laddish.
Oh yes. Yeah. Yes.
But no, I just think it's quite interesting to have, because obviously every Doctor Who story, if it wants to or not, is a political statement, and many papers and books and so on have been written about Doctor Who and its relationship to the politics of the time, and I just think that it's interesting watching that with those shadows in the background. I mean, again, I mentioned 28 Days Later earlier, and how that kind of darkness, that kind of idea of a country under threat from this kind of, with Shalka, the masses that are the threat are like begging the people sending them to die to stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's I mean, you could,
but entirely powerless to stop.
Yes, exactly. And like, again, this is after the most people worldwide protesting a single thing in human history failed to stop the thing they were protesting. Yeah, and so through that lens, you can see the final screaming match as a victory for, you know, the quote unquote human voice over its oppressors. Mm-hmm. Am I right, comrades? Am I right? Like,
I mean, again, why cabaret then? Why this story about
living
life and enjoying yourself as the Nazi war machine is encroaching around you and you know it's about to stamp on your neck.
Yeah.
But you're going to have a little bit of fun in the meantime.
Yeah, and he does. He does have a lot of fun right at the end. Like, he's basically taunting the baddies across the last episode, which is something that you do like to see the Doctor do.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are references to WMDs. There are a couple of references to regime change. It's something that dates it really specifically, I think, even more than the talk of illegal raves and Allison's haircut
and tasting the air of 2003.
Oh, I don't want to taste the air of 2003.
I don't want to taste the air of 2020, but there you go.
That's that monologue over.
I think that's really interesting and really insightful, much more than like the very plain surface level look is like, it's an environmental story. That's obvious. The one interesting twist they do on that is like, when Allison has control of the throat singing quartet, that she apparently could have used it to fix the atmosphere and destroy the greenhouse gases.
But the doctor's like, no, humans should clean up their own mess. I like that moment right at the end is also like the only thing Allison gets to actively do throughout the whole thing. Like, in stark contrast to Rose, Billy Piper's character, you know, what she would become in terms of being a much more proactive, much more of a person.
Yeah.
Allison is...
You are comparing her to what she would become rather than her introductory story.
Okay, that's true.
Which is just the same, you know, I feel like there's more to be done, but I don't know what to do. I don't know what direction to be pointed in. And then in the climactic moment, one clear action.
Yeah, you know what? No, they are actually a lot more similar than I thought. At least in terms of the single episode. I think maybe it felt more egregious with Allison because this is stretched out over 90 minutes.
That's fair. That is also fair.
And like, given that 95 minutes of that is her sort of just being shuttled around between baddies and goodies.
It would have been nice if she had a little bit more agency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
rather than agency, she gets empathy. Oh, okay. She gets the chance to really understand the Doctor far more than anyone else does. Also, she challenges Joe and is trying to navigate, like, this isn't the time to talk about our relationship, but I'm going to subtextually very, very loudly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he can't deal with that.
Yeah, yeah. Again, Joe is just a bit crap throughout the whole thing. Which is fine, because that's what the story needs him to be.
Yeah.
And, like...
Mm-hmm.
And we already spend a bit too much time with him anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And to compare him to Mickey in Rose, like, oh God, Mickey got bad direction in Rose. I love that character in every other episode. But in the big, like, which way are you going to go? Who are you going to go with scene? Like, he's clinging to her leg like a beaten dog or whatever.
Gosh.
Joe at least doesn't go down like that.
No,
you know?
Joe barely goes down at all. He's just, as you can tell from the state of their relationship, boom! <Yeah. laughs>
That's Allison's problem. Yeah, obviously.
Oh, okay.
Entirely fair.
I don't want to get into what the Doctor and Master could offer.
Yeah, let's let someone else do that.
Yeah, I'm sure they already have.
Yes, I'm sure they have.
Anyway, I think it's time for...
Tickle Fights.
Tickle Fights.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about, yeah.
So, final thoughts on Scream of the Shalker. What do we think? Alex, let's start with you.
I mean, as we've said, incredibly ambitious for being, like, one 90-minute chunk of what was going to be, like, the running
A new
on,
series, yeah.
Yeah, like, Ninth Doctor. And... it's really interesting to look at this, especially like all the other stuff that we've looked at on the show has been like is nearly entirely amateur production.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to like hear about all like the red tape that would be, like that would hold back the production of a Flash animation.
Yeah, exactly.
like, cause you just when you talk about Flash, you think about Newgrounds and you think about like just. Freelance animators doing a thing, you don't think about like people running around the BBC trying to clear out the right to use the name of Doctor Who.
Yeah, you don't think
online.
Yeah,
you don't
yeah.
think of someone desperately on the phone to Richard E. Grant's agent begging them to return a favor.
Yeah, no, please bring it to my house. Wow.
Okay, all right. It's what if we've talked to the writer, it's only one line of singing and one note, okay? We think we can just use the one note over and over again.
Oh, dear. It is definitely, as climaxes go,
yeah.
one of the noisiest in a...
yeah, maybe one of the noisiest I've ever seen.
Yeah. And don't worry, Flashketeers, you can clip that and use it out of context as much as you
yeah,
want.
Yeah, absolutely, go ahead.
I know, personally, I think I really do enjoy it. I think I loved it when I was 13.
Mm.
I don't love it now, obviously, but because things have changed so much, but I recognize its importance and also its relative impotence, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so it remains this lovely, ambitious, aborted project that did the best it could, straining against like massive concrete barriers.
I mean, you have to wonder, like, because when you have a studio like Cosgrove Hall, they use Flash because I guess they wanted to put it online.
Yeah, this was meant to be a webcast,
but. Also, at the same time, part of my brain's like, okay, but why not just go the whole hog, just make it a cartoon and put it on television?
Well, at the time, Flash was becoming, in the post-dot-com bubble media landscape, Flash and online animation were...
It was the future.
Yeah, they were the future. I mean, like, coming out around this time, you also had projects like Monkey Dust.
Oh, of course,
A wonderful, terrible sketch show, which we will cover in a future episode.
Yeah.
You know, you have, you know, I mean, this is not long before, like, you know, Weeble and Bob would be selling butter.
They're Weeble and Bob.
You know,
every time I remember that.
But also you have traditional cartoons like home movies, for instance, turning to Flash for its primary animation engine. And so like Scream of the Shulker kind of comes just at the crest of this new wave before the new status quo would establish itself. And as it's a really good try, I think.
I think it gives me a new appreciation for all the amateur stuff that we've seen. That we've criticized, like, for being maybe a little stiff, because, like, as much as this is great and the style is amazing, like, it is ever so slightly stilted.
Like
you were saying, like, you never see a character below the waist because...
The action scenes aren't.
Obviously, they couldn't work out or didn't want to work out. Like you were
There's
saying.
One pretty good
there
punch.
There is a pretty good
the
punch.
The doctor punches Joe.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
Yeah, after which he sort of shakes his wrist out in a love. that was great. I enjoyed that.
I think, like you were saying, maybe they just didn't want to work out how to make a character walk or move or show that.
It would have been so much work.
It would have been a lot of work.
And, like, one thing that you mentioned, Grant, which comes to mind, is that this was directed by someone who had only directed theatre. Clearly, whoever was in charge of production saw this as a new medium. If you're not going to be able to direct people in the same way, you're not going to be able to direct animators in the same way as you might have done before, then you go back to, you know, someone who just...
Just working with actors in space.
Yeah, working with actors, working with voices, working with scripts. And the script for this is pretty good. It would have worked as a radio play easily.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a thought I had while we were watching. It was like, this feels like a radio play that they've put animation to a little bit.
Yeah, you just need a little more expository dialogue.
Yeah, just a little bit more. Yeah. It would have essentially been like a dramatization, but some Flash animation.
Yeah, get the Doctor to remark on Allison's cornrow beads. Grant, what you can have the final say on that.
No, I really enjoy this as like a historical curiosity sounds belittling, but just, you know, the road not taken, a fork that had a dead end sign hastily put at the end of it.
There but for the grace of Russell T. Davies.
Because it's so interesting, like, we've been talking about all of the things it has in common with the new TV series that came immediately after it, immediately in the time it takes to make television happen, at least. That so much of it is just so many of the similarities, besides a few, you know, historical coincidences like David Tennant, are just because that is what the show would be in the 2003 zeitgeist. That's how you would relaunch an old brand, but still keep it the same thing for a new generation. I mean, a generation and a half later.
16 years, wasn't it?
89 to 2005, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's
a long time to be off the air, but like still be fondly remembered by we're saying, like people like us who've never seen it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and there were, you know, countless fan works and radio dramas and magazines. The magazine was an extremely powerful cultural force, at least within those circles. For a
so
time.
You should not lock them in closets. No, it's rude.
Exactly. I think if we take one thing away from our discussion today, it's
don't lock journalists.
If you're trying to impress a journalist, don't lock them in anywhere, really, unless it's an escape room, and in which case, put other things in the room.
Give him something to entertain himself with. Come on.
They could have at least given him a Game Boy.
Maybe it was supposed to be 7 minutes in heaven with Derek Jacobi, but he just didn't show up that day.
Every minute with Derek Jacobi is a minute in heaven. obviously this is a full BBC own brand production, and so it's not posted anywhere that would have comment sections to delve.
No, I was actually going to say to you before, what are we going to do about comments? But
well, I think we've had more than enough discussion to fill the time. Yeah. Would you be amenable, Grant?
Not long after this came out, they removed the forums on the Doctor Who website.
I wonder if they're connected.
Yeah. Or it's more connected to the fan reaction. Or shall we say the online fan reaction to the subset that were already on the Doctor Who forums to Billy Piper's casting. That was apparently the final straw for some people.
Wow. I mean, they cast her because they want to. Because they want to. So, last episode, we asked you, wonderful Flashketeers, where on earth is this link? Oh, wait, I closed it.
It's the same place where I put my memory of the name City of Death.
Oh, there you go.
So embarrassing.
Is that the one where the Doctor like graphically drowns?
Ah, that's the Deadly Assassin.
Deadly Assassin, my mistake. Yes.
City of Death is the really good Douglas Adams story.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. Okay. I think I have seen that one actually, but again, this would have been a long, long time ago. I need to. What most of what this has made me realize is that I want to watch more Doctor Who. So, on our last episode, we gave you lovely listeners, you Flashketeers, a prompt basically saying that we talk about a lot of stuff that hasn't aged very well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it comes with the territory.
It's from the past. And yeah. Sometimes it doesn't hold up.
So we asked you folks to email in telling us stuff that you think has aged well or is even better than it was when it first arrived. So our first email is from Arp, friend of the show. Arp said the Speed Racer movie by the Wachowskis is still an amazing movie that is upbeat, very funny and colourful. A capitalist gets dunked on and everything else we need in this time of quarantine.
couldn't agree more.
The Speed Racer movie is a feast.
Excellent.
Is a feast for the senses. And they continue and say, parts of the Indiana Jones films, mainly the first and third one, are still very good too, as killing Nazis never goes out of style.
There you go.
Thank you very much. We've also got one from Great Joe, our frenemy, who says, media that's aged very well? Easy. Pompeii Graffiti.
Okay.
It's a lot of toilet humor and saying whichever guy has a huge dick. Other than that, I guess a lot of 80s and 90s horror films got a lot better about a year after release, when they got transferred to VHS, putting all that wildly coloured noise in all the pitch black parts of the frame. Mm. That's an interesting perspective,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, when you're scared and on edge and watching something in the dark, and you see shapes moving... yeah. And they finishes by saying, in a way, Flash cartoons as well, just in terms of graphical fidelity, have aged remarkably since the Flash standard is all vector-based, so they can be scaled up to fill whatever screen you have.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Flash looks better now than it did when we were all, you know, running dial-up.
Yeah, it really does. Let's see, Jordan wrote in and said, quite simply, I think most Homestar Runner still holds up. And also, bizarrely, a ton of stick figure fights.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. I mean, we've talked about both extensively. Mm. I think I think what holds up the most about... I mean, Homestar Runner, we talked about being particularly timeless in its humor. Yeah. And the stick figures fights, I think, something that simple?
Yeah, yeah. When all you've got is choreography, if it was good then, it's still going to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to say. Yeah, I mean we definitely enjoyed Zhao Zhao.
Hey, Zhao Zhao was great.
Zhao Zhao was really fun, yeah. And Zhao Zhao is, it's just stick people, but it's fun.
Lest we forget that you know, the Zhao Zhao guy sued Nike.
Of course.
And won.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you wanna hear more, listen to episode 32. Episode 32. ZS said, dear audio lovelies, after a good long think, I'd say a thing that has genuinely aged well is Dave the Tentacle.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's just really, really funny, and I keep coming back to it. Hope you all are doing well. Thank you. We're doing all right.
Yeah, we're doing okay.
And Day of the Tentacle. Have you ever played Day of the Tentacle?
I actually haven't ever played Day of the Tentacle.
It is a lovely... It's like the LucasArts adventure game, almost.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard a lot of people like say a lot of good things about it. So it's been one of those things like, at some point I'll check this out. And I will, because I'm actually a big fan of like LucasArts point and click stuff.
It's just charming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I don't know. I wonder how well its depiction of the founding fathers in a cartoon sense holds up. But then that was the style at the time.
It was.
What do y'all think about those guys over there?
I mean, most of them spent a lot of time here or in France anyway. So, like, I don't know. It just seems like a strange kind of hero worship. We have our own genocidal fuckwads to worship over here. Say, thank you very much.
We spend too much time staring at pictures of Churchill and,
yeah. And finally, RBD writes in and says, since I've been holed up in quarantine, I've been rewatching a bunch of old media from my childhood. Hey, same. Back to back, I watch Beavis and Butthead Do America and South Park Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. One definitely held up more than the other. South Park felt of its time, most like a Newgrounds Flash animation, but Beavis and Butthead was a proper good nostalgia trip.
Yeah, no, that's a great movie.
Yeah. Have you seen Beavis and Butthead Do America?
I actually haven't. Oh, I actually haven't seen it.
I'm gonna acquire it legally as soon as we end this recording.
Okay.
Just wait until the Criterion release. It's coming any year now.
If Beavis and Butthead the Criterion collection.
I mean, if Armageddon got a Criterion release, then...
Well, yeah, they're both brilliant films. I don't understand what you're trying to say.
There's no reason why they wouldn't be in the Criterion Collection.
You're right, my mistake. that leads it to us. So what comes to mind for me is in terms of messaging and in terms of allegory, there are a few films which have only become more relevant with time. The first one that comes to mind is Starship Troopers. Whoa. Because Starship Troopers in 1997 was a ridiculous farce. Starship Troopers, with the hindsight of 2020, was frightening.
Yeah.
In terms of everything from the generation of mediatized war, from the smiley service guarantees citizenship style fascism, to Neil Patrick Harris being beloved, all terrible, terrible futures that the world would have to endure. I don't mean that, Neil, if you're listening. I mean, no, you
nice.
Are.
Be
Neil,
nice
if you're listening, please write into the show, flashinthepancast@gmail.com. But also...
What an interesting perspective. I would like to know more.
And also Network. Again, Network is almost a cliche now that Network is more and more relevant since it came out. I mean, Network is from the 70s, and yet it still kind of diagnoses a lot of just the media landscape and its co-option and reproduction of radical speech into marketable bite-sized chunks. On a nicer note, the Josie and the Pussycats film, mint, with Rosario Dawson, it's really good. It's such a good film.
I've got to talk about that on my show.
Oh, have you not yet? Well then,
not yet.
But yeah, Josie and the Pussycats is just a delightful film that even though it's definitely of its time, mm-hmm. it is so unapologetically embracing all of the style and the color and the excitement of the era in which it was made, that every time I watch it, I appreciate it a bit more.
Josie and the Pussycats was not served well by Spice World coming out first and being terrible.
Oh my goodness. Spice World, that's a whole other podcast, I think.
Oof. I'm not prepared to get into that right now.
Viva Forever is the best Spice Girls song. I'm just putting it out there.
Okay, if you're sure.
I am. Grant, do you have any thoughts on stuff that's aged particularly well?
Gillian Anderson.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Gillian Anderson, I think that's a fair answer.
You know what? Just because of... I think it's just floated to the forefront of my mind because of what we've been talking about, and also Douglas Adams has been mentioned a few times. Hitchhiker's Guide.
Hitchhiker's Guide is good. It's very good.
I'm never disappointed when I revisit Hitchhiker's Guide, whether it's the movie, which I like.
All right.
Or the books. They're just really fucking good.
For me, Hitchhiker's Guide will always be the radio series.
The radio series.
Which I love. And
it is excellent, yeah.
And get entire scenes from stuck in my head from time to time.
Okay, Peter Davison did have a small role in the Hitchhiker's Guide TV series. Okay,
yes,
tied it
did.
Back.
There you go.
Tied it back.
There we go.
There we go.
It's all come full circle. See, this is why you've got the podcast empire.
Yep. I was able to mention the father-in-law of Caretaker Number 2, so it's tied back to Scream of the Shulker.
There we go.
There we go.
Although, the robot master in earlier drafts was a hologram Fifth Doctor. Peter Davison would have been represented in Scream of the Shulker.
Ooh.
Mm.
Interesting.
But then the decision was made, wouldn't it be a more interesting relationship if it's, you know...
If it's his old boyfriend.
Exactly.
Yeah. I can only agree.
Yes.
Really. That just makes the most sense.
It is the highlight of the whole, like, I enjoy this story. I've been having fun. But if you had to pick, like, one best part, it's just the master. Every line is a delight.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It's just dripping with aloof smugness. Mm-hmm.
And the potential of that a three-way pull of a relationship if this did have, you know, a full series follow it.
Yeah. There must be...
It's got to exist.
...books and fan fiction that have explored this.
Like, if it doesn't, I will be shocked.
Yeah.
Right? If it doesn't, I've got one more project to work on.
Hey, there you go. Something to do.
But yeah, so that was a lovely email section. Thank you all so much for emailing in and telling us about stuff that you remember.
Yeah.
Stuff that's good. It's nice. It's nice to talk about stuff that's good.
And it's nice to hear from our listeners.
Yeah, it really is. And in honor of the Ninth Doctor's endless name dropping, please let us know. By emailing in to flashinthepancast@gmail.com. Just tell us about your celebrity encounters. Why not? I'm sure you've got a story or two.
He's got at least one person.
At least one person brushed past Miriam Margolyes in a stairwell once.
Or something like that.
Yeah. and of course, you can email in any other comments, suggestions. We love your suggestions.
Yes.
We have a big pile of cartoons to watch, and more than half of them have come from your suggestions, so
yes,
keep those coming in. And all of that can be sent to flashinthepancast@gmail.com. You can find all three of us on the internet.
Wow.
Let's start with Grant. Grant, where can people find you?
I named a lot of my projects at the top, and now I'm going to give them a little bit of description so people don't have more than a name. You can pick out, you know, what you actually like. So I do a history podcast with my wife called History Honeys, where we take turns teaching each other about cool, fun stuff. Now is a great time to start listening because our episode that comes out on May 12th is our 100th episode. I've got something special planned for that.
Wow. Congratulations.
We also have a second show together called Sex Archie, where we talk about the television program Riverdale. And wouldn't you know it, it's a great time to start listening to that one too, because they just completed their fourth season. And so we completed our fourth season.
Excellent.
I have an actual play show called 6 Feet Under, where me and a bunch of friends and frankly, a whole lot of people. We have a large stable of talent.
Yeah, I was on there once, way back.
Yeah. Which game was that?
Eclipse Phase.
It was Eclipse Phase. That's right.
Back in the long ago.
where we play tabletop role-playing games and use them to make stories and have fun together. We are continually starting and ending our one-shots and mini-series, so there's always something either just wrapped up to catch up on or something brand new to jump into. In fact, I'm reminded, speaking of the long, long ago days, we did a game called Danger Patrol, and I, my character was just the Shulka Doctor, actually. I turned this incarnation into my player character for Danger Patrol. You could tell because I won't stop name dropping various historical and pop culture figures through the era.
Fantastic.
And you can go on YouTube and see video stuff rather than just podcasts where one of my oldest dearest friends and I talk over video game footage at chipandironicus.com. We are finishing up post-game stuff from Super Mario Odyssey, but we also have probably the greatest thing we've ever done, all complete now, a very long, very thorough series on Metal Gear Solid 5.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That is very exciting.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Metal Gear Solid 5 is fun for the whole family. Mario, really no kids allowed. That is not for kids.
Well, yeah. I mean, gosh.
Not the way we talk about it. I don't know. Something makes the Mario videos filthy, and I don't know why.
I was going to say, it is definitely one of the most sexually charged Mario Odyssey LPs I've seen.
God, I can't imagine one more so. It would be very uncomfortable.
just the nose jiggle physics sets you off every time.
I mean, you had a whole cliffhanger about Mario's taint. I mean,
it's true.
It's
true, and you should say it.
Yes, it's just incredible.
Is there anything else you'd like to plug? A Twitter handle?
You can find me sharing my thoughts and often just promoting all of those things on Twitter at GEN_Ironicus, IRONICUS.
Nice. Thank you very much. Alex, you're online, for better or worse.
For better or worse, I'm terminally online. You can find me on Twitter at DEX01, where I sometimes do tweets like stray thoughts or like cool stuff that I might be doing. I don't unfortunately have any cool stuff lined up at the moment.
Apart from this cool podcast.
Apart from this cool podcast, hey. And you can find my music if you enjoy the theme tune for the show that me and Tom wrote together. I did all the instrumentation.
I did the vox, as they say in the business.
You can find all the music, which doesn't sound too far off what you hear on the theme tune, alexvalentine.bandcamp.com, and also you can find me on Spotify and Apple Music. If you search for Alexander Valentine, I come up. I'm right there.
Wow, there you are.
Click on my face.
Click on her face. And as always, you can find me on Twitter at Gertrude Perkins. That's Gertrude, P-R-K-N-S. You can find the show's Twitter at FlashITPancast or FlashItPancast. As we mentioned, you can email in flashinthepancast@gmail.com. Check out the website for all the previous episodes, all the stuff we've been talking about, flashinthepancast.com. As always, thank you very much to Alicia Goranson for her web hosting. You can check her out at alicia-goranson.com. Oh, I can never remember this. alicia-goranson.com. Until next time, I've been Tom.
I've been Alex.
And I've been Grant.
And until next time, remember, as the actress said to the bishop, I'm not human and I don't care.
Have a nice flash.
So the way we do this is that we say the word flash and then we all say the word ah, because that's the joke.
Okay.
It's a pun. It's a pun that at least one of our listeners wrote in a while ago to say that they only just got. Which...
Oh my god, really?
Shout out to you. You know who you are. We love you very dearly.
Please don't stop listening.
Please.